Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
I'm struggling with this in San Francisco because I can't actually figure out if we can fix it or not. There are structural things here that are making it really hard to change, and the machine is all on the other side, and I'm not even convinced at this point that tech people fully mobilized could do much. There aren't that many tech people in the city to begin with, even before COVID, comparatively. But then in the national context, I think it's an easier question to think about. It's like America is slowly falling, let's say, and I believe actually we are in a sort of rough state of decline in a lot of dimensions. It gets really bad. Do you stay and fight or do you leave? And I personally believe that you stay and fight. I think it's like, this is my home, this is my country, I'm going to stay and I'm going to fight for it.
This week, we're very excited to welcome Michael Solana to the podcast. Mike is a vice president at Founders Fund, which is a venture capital fund out of San Francisco. He also writes the Pirate Wires newsletter on Substack. He is a great follow on Twitter as well. He's basically been on Marshall and I's radar for over a year. He's always very aggressive online and fights around tech, the future of San Francisco, California, and more. And we thought that we would have a great conversation, which is exactly what happened.
A constant theme of our more recent episodes has been our idea that one of the biggest problems with media discourse, with politics in general, has been the fact that we've lost the local in our politics. And Mike is interesting in that he's focused on San Francisco, the debates in the city around crime, housing, homelessness. He's bringing a very concerted, very aggressive tech industry perspective to that. So you're definitely not going to agree with everything that he says. But the part that I really appreciate with him is just how he's focused on the local in a way that is difficult for a lot of us, especially living in big cities. He takes Sagar and I to task for not knowing who our local ward committee men, committee persons are.
Right. He also got mad at me because I said San Francisco wasn't that great. A position, by the way, I continue to hold despite his very compelling case that he makes here. Mike is a very outspoken guy. I'm sure if you guys don't like tech, this is probably not the person to listen to. But I do think it is worth sitting through and hearing him out. We like to have people from all sides of the debate here on the podcast. Okay, so you guys know that we have a lot of asks of you every episode, and after enough feedback, I get it, it's annoying. So from this point forward, there will only be one ask per episode. The ask this week is to please check out our bookshop that we mentioned in our episode with Cal Newport previously. Here's the deal with Bookshop. It's an awesome website where you can go on and order a book, which will be sourced from an independent bookstore, which is suffering right now during the COVID-19 pandemic depression. At the same time, it helps the show out. And a common question that I get from you guys is, well, can I buy any book from Bookshop and still help the show? Yeah, exactly. That's one of the coolest parts. Just follow the link, which is available on our Substack. It's available on our Instagram. It's available also in the show notes. And you will be able to purchase any book, whatever book you were going to purchase anyway, or the ones that we recommend to you. Marshall and I have curated lists there that you can also check out and peruse as well if you like what we're all about.
There's three different lists. List number one is all of the books that our realignment guests have written. There's a huge number of them. So if you find yourself enjoying a conversation, definitely go check those out. And we also have our best reads of 2020. We all were locked up for long periods, so we had plenty of time to shoot through Audible and read a bunch of paperback books. So definitely go check there if you're looking for what we thought were the best reads. And finally, we have our weekly updated whatever we've been reading the past week in the year 2021. That is a constantly moving list. If you're ever curious what we're reading and want to check it out, that's the right list to go and follow.
That's right. Okay, so let's get to the question and answer period. What do we got, Marshall?
This is from a fun little app. Love the podcast. I've been a riser since the summer of 2019 when the primaries started, and I've been tuning in daily since. Just started listening to The Realignment on my commute to and from the Naval Academy, not far from DC. In that vein, I'm wondering how important the military and foreign policy will be to voters over the coming years. It's common to hear people claim that voters don't care about foreign policy. Is that true? I was very young when the Iraq War was a hot topic. I don't remember how much of a factor it was in 2004 and 2008, especially for presidential races. War and foreign policy should matter a lot since the president of the United States has so much unilateral power in that realm. ISIS and Libya were raised in 2016, but I don't remember how big a deal it was with most voters or even pundits. Do we have too much going on domestically, even pro-COVID, with healthcare, wages, and social divisions for the greater population to be concerned for what's happening 1,000 miles away? This is actually a great question because you charted out the course of presidential politics with foreign policy. So, year 2004, foreign policy was everything. It was a security election. That was a world that was still reeling, a world and the United States that was still reeling from September 11th and the decision to go into Iraq. So that was a presidential campaign that was all about foreign policy. John Kerry was nominated because of his Vietnam War and foreign affairs experiences. 2008, same deal. The election you missed was 2006, where Democrats won the midterms over a combination of George W. Bush's poor handling of Hurricane Katrina and the then disaster in Iraq before the surge was fully implemented. The key thing there, though, is after 2008 and after what I would probably say is the is President Obama's killing of Osama bin Laden in 2011, you did see foreign policy take more of a backseat. Obviously, there's always going to be a conversation around endless wars and Afghanistan and our presence there, ISIS, obviously. But in many ways, those decisions, because the body counts, to be frank, were not incredibly high. I remember during the Iraq War, you'd watch the news and there would be 10, 12, 15 people every single night you were hearing about either being killed or being wounded. That just makes the slow burn of our current engagements different.
I'm glad you said that, Marshall, because that's basically my answer, which is that foreign policy is just not at the top of people's lists. But whenever it is, it matters big, if that makes sense to everybody. As in, it basically lurks under the surface. And if you make a gigantic mistake, then you're done. And I think the important thing to remember here is that one of the most pernicious things that's evolved, in my view, is that people have figured out how to put foreign policy basically on autopilot and have figured out that as long as you only lose about 20 Americans a year in Afghanistan, that the American people just won't give a shit. And they're largely right. That is essentially what has happened, is that you can have the same relative foreign policy with a much lighter footprint and pass it all on to the Afghan National Security Forces and continue to waste billions and billions of dollars on them as they continue to get clobbered and the Taliban continues to run more and more parts of the country. So I think it is obviously incredibly important, but the fact of the matter is it will not matter, just as most things will not matter, unless it tangibly affects Americans' lives in a big way. And we just haven't seen that happen yet. Although, always remember that because of the power of the presidency, you're only one screw up away from making that happen. So there's still an immense amount of responsibility there.
Great answer. And last but not least, a huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. Mike Solana, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Mike.
So we are recording this right after President Biden announced that around May, let's be generous and give May, June, July, there'll be enough vaccines available for every adult and teacher in the country to be vaccinated, which brings to mind the fact that every time we've had anyone on from the tech industry or the venture capital world where you work, there's been a big debate about how much the world isn't or isn't changing due to COVID. And it seems like once there's a vaccine majority in the country, at least we'll have a bit of a metric for a starting point for reanalyzing who had the right takes the past year. So I guess the real question to start with for you is, how much do you think things will go back to quote unquote normal once there is some majority of the population vaccinated?
I think it's a great question. I don't know. I think nobody really knows. For me, I can say that this entire debate, like the COVID thing, revealed the cracks in the foundations of the modern world, I think. The San Francisco context is like, San Francisco's been bad for a long time, and we've just sort of limped along and not paid much attention to the government. And it was like, oh, we can get along without it. We don't really need it. it was just in the middle of a crisis, suddenly you realize, oh, wow, an incompetent government is really disastrous. And so I think maybe the one thing that certainly, in terms of where people are going to be living, right? Like, it's like this Miami thing, is like the Austin thing, or is this going to be real? I don't know. We have, Founders Fund has an office in Miami now. But this is a conversation that Founders Fund has been having internally for years. Peter left San Francisco years ago, and we have been allowed to move for a while. Peter's asked me to move to Los Angeles. It's something that we've talked about, and I think it's something that people in the technology industry have talked about for a long time. The city is really messed up in a lot of ways. So I think it's like, well, things go back to normal. I mean, people are going to be going to bars and restaurants again, I think. I think that's all definitely going to happen. I think people are going to go back. There will definitely be a population increase in San Francisco, I think for sure. But I think that what we've really learned is the degree to which, I think most people now have seen sort of like viscerally the degree to which an incompetent government can really cripple you. And that's at the national level as well as the local level. But for me, I tend to focus on the local stuff because I think that that's the stuff that no one ever cares about. And it's actually much more important for our day-to-day lives. I mean, everything that we care about for the most part in our actual lives is affected by local politics. And so I think that my hopeful cut is that people are going to remember this lesson and they're going to be frustrated and they're going to be more focused and maybe they, maybe we start to see some change there at the local level. I do think that a lot of the work from home stuff is going to stick though. Like, I think at this point, if you work for any of the huge technology companies and you're in your sort of 30s and you're looking to buy a house and have a family, it no longer makes sense to be in San Francisco. I think a lot of that work is going to be pushed out. We're going to start seeing people in all sorts of cities all over the country. I think a lot of that is really serious. A lot of the CEOs I've talked to are really serious about staying out. Where I think that you'll probably see a resurgence of activity is the startup level, because there is just still so much talent in San Francisco and there is so much money in San Francisco. And now that rent's a little bit cheaper, people in their 20s who are building companies, and of course, this is not to say, I mean, people start startups at every age, 20s, right, 30s, 40s, but like, and beyond. But I think you'll start to see younger people. You're already seeing younger people in the city again, and sort of making the same mistakes that I made 10 years ago, moving in, not thinking about it, not caring about it, not even knowing who my supervisors are, not even knowing who represents me in local politics, not even knowing what the structure of our local politics are, and not caring because you're busy building really cool shit and that's all that matters. And you're really excited about that. You're seeing that again. And I think that once the city opens up, you'll see more of it. But yeah, like I said, big companies are going to be, people are going to be working all over the country. And I do expect to see bigger companies start growing in other parts of, that's been a trend again that predates COVID. So a lot of what happened under COVID is, it's like COVID didn't really do anything. It just accelerated some trends that already existed and revealed the real, I think, problems we're facing. So I guess that's a long way of saying, I think there will be some changes, but they're not going to be so black and white, which is, I guess, a boring answer.
No, it's not. And actually, we talked about this here on the show, which is that we had Derek Thompson, we did a whole remote work episode. And it's like, look, even if 10% of the white collar workforce in America uproots and moves from where they are, that's one of the largest demographic transitions in modern American history, even if just 10%. So that alone is something that's important. This is another question I want to level to you because, you know, remote work and, like you said, Peter Thiel already left San Francisco like a while back. People were already kind of acclimatized to this within tech. But I've always watched kind of the cultural norms get born out on the West Coast and then kind of seep through the rest of the country during specific moments. I think COVID is definitely one of them. How do you think this is going to change? Basically, it's like you said, because human capital concentration in San Francisco was also, frankly, the only reason why like people were really moving there. Like, it's kind of, I mean, look, I have my biases, but like, it's kind of cold.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not particularly that great. I'll let you make your case. I've seen a lot of people who have left the city. How do you think that's going to change that? And I'm sure you have a rebuttal to what I just said.
Well, I think it's what you're saying is wrong. I think that one thing that San Francisco has nothing in common with Detroit, for example, is that it, the industry, the value does not come just from the industry. San Francisco has been a popular city forever. It's an historically exciting city. It's a city of like vibrant cultural history. But then geographically, it's stunning. I think it might be the most beautiful city, certainly in the country. Maybe it's one of the most beautiful cities in the world in terms of just like the crazy geography, the fog and the mountains, the bay all around you. You're surrounded by gorgeous natural phenomena, the redwood forests. You have Napa Valley like seconds away. In any single direction you go, it's just like beautiful, just like forests and water and everything else. All of that's amazing. You have the beautiful architecture style, like the sort of Victorian houses everywhere. It's very unique looking. It reminds me of New Orleans, actually, in that like there's stuff that exists in San Francisco. San Francisco's a thing that is only really here. It's not like a type. It's not like New York City where it's like, there are lots of versions of New York City all over the world. It's just like the big American city looking thing. San Francisco is very specific. And so there are going to be people who want to live here no matter what, just because it's beautiful. And a lot of people, I agree with the weather. I don't like that it's always sort of perpetually 60 degrees and foggy, but people love that. People always talk about the weather as one of the things that they like about it, that it's steady and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I mean, what was the other part of your question?
I think that's good, by the way. We need San Francisco, Sam. My sister works in tech. She's leaving San Francisco because she's like, I can't stand it, but largely for the reasons that you're saying, which is crime. And that's actually largely a mismanagement issue than it is in terms of the natural beauty. You're totally correct. I was more wondering whether and how you see the future of tech itself, since you work in the industry, how it might change as a result of this kind of remotization. Like with everything going online, there was something to be said about San Francisco at the end of the day was a small-ish type city in terms of the business district in particular. There was like the organic, like running into each other concept, not just within day-to-day business, but also socially as well. How does that change the industry and how things downstream get funded, developed, etc., now that we do have this kind of remote phenomenon? Like you said, now you have an office in Miami. Like I know my sister's company, like they have one in like London. Now she's going to be in New York City. Marshall's, you know, in New York. It's just like with the remote work, if you know somebody already, it's not a problem. But in terms of the new organic connections, to be a big downside.
Yes. This is what a lot of people, I think, in the conversation are discounting because they're older. And so they're not acknowledging how important it is to be around people physically when you're just starting out. I would have nothing that I have today if it wasn't for actual real world physical meetings between really, I mean, me and a handful of people who changed the trajectory of my career. And that happened because it started when I was in New York and then it carried on into San Francisco. These are big, huge cities with lots of people and it's easier to meet people in those places. And so I believe that the human draw is towards that kind of thing. I think creative people want to be near each other, and they tend to concentrate in specific areas. So I think maybe what you see, I think that it's just, I think that people certainly are going to want to start their careers in places where lots of people physically are. And I don't believe that the remote only thing is going to be it. So where will, I think it does make a lot of sense in the context of a giant mature company, and maybe even most people are interested in that long term. Maybe most people aren't interested in some kind of career where they're like starting their own company and it's like insane ambition and all of this kind of stuff, and that's fine, and they're just going to have a cool job. They're going to be working in like HR for Google and they can do it remotely from Florida, whatever. I work at a venture capital firm and we are focused on startups, and I think those people, that's the only sort of view that I can speak confidently on. I think that those people are going to want to be close to each other in vibrant areas with lots of people and lots of talent. And I don't think that's going to change. And I think it's going to center. I think Miami could be a place where you see cool stuff happening, but I don't think there's going to be one monopoly San Francisco anymore. I think that's pretty much been shattered. But I do think that there will still be urban areas where people congregate at the beginning of their career if they're very ambitious, and that these places will be really exciting places to be in the future for all sorts of things, not just startups probably. Like I think a lot of just young ambitious people want to be near each other. But then once a company matures, like, yeah, I think that the way that San Francisco changes is that all of the people who don't need to be here won't.
That makes sense.
You said something really interesting when you were making the pro case for San Francisco. You were talking about the architectural beauty and the history. I know you're very much a, we should develop more, we should build more housing. Mm-hmm. The phraseology you use is very much the phraseology used by people who are opposed to development, who say, well, in terms of like the way they articulate, there's like, we have a unique character, adding more housing will really change that. So I'm interested in how you come at the housing debate when you're also very much articulating really, really poignantly the parts of the city that you like. It doesn't seem like you're calling for San Francisco to turn into a giant set of apartment complexes.
Yeah. Right. So two things. The first one is I'm not making a pro San Francisco argument. I think it's complicated. I think it's going to be sort of just, I think you're going to see an exodus of a certain kind of person. I think it will still sort of persist as a great place to be for startups, but there are going to be several hubs for startups. And then I actually think, I mean, San Francisco is fucked in a lot of ways and it frustrates me and drives me crazy. And I myself struggle with whether or not I should be there because I think it is so poorly managed that at a certain point, like there's something mentally wrong with you if you want to stay in a place that hates you this much. I mean, literally it's like crime, violent crime, home invasion is sort of quasi-legal here. And that's really crazy. So I'm not making a pro San Francisco argument. I just think that it's not black and white. And I think people will live here. And I think that you could still make, and you will have great career opportunities here. Then though, on the housing stuff, you can just live. Most of the buildings in San Francisco are like, so first of all, you have a downtown area and that should just be like blow it up, right? Like not blow it up. I mean like lift it up, like more everywhere. Like let people build all around there. There's plenty of room. There are plenty of like down in Soma and stuff. I mean, you have all sorts of just like, it's like lots of big buildings, but lots of sort of like two or three story buildings, like lift them all the way up. Like the warehouses, like anything that you have, like go for it. Any property you own, you should just have the right to build up and up and up as long as it's safe, safely constructed. But then in terms of all of the like residential stuff where you have like maybe a four story Victorian house, or a three story Victorian house, I think that, I think Paris might be like seven or eight stories. You have all these beautiful buildings. It's one of the most, Paris is like famously one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Like I think that there's something analogous in there. Like I would be fine if we had, and this is where Yimby's would like pounce on me and be like, no, it's like just about like building buildings and shoving people in boxes. And I'm like, okay, cool. But like, we have to find a way to compromise here. And I think that the compromise is you make sure that it's still beautiful and you allow people to build in the same style and to maintain the same character. But you're like, hey, if you own this building, you're allowed to do this exact, you're allowed to lift it up four more stories. And I think that people are going to do like with a market. If the market incentive is there, I think people will build it and maybe even five stories. Like, let's get crazy. Let's just lift this. I think it's like, I want to just see the city like lifted up a little bit. That's one part. But then the other important part is like mass transit and like reliable mass transit. And you need to make sure that, I mean, the Bay Area's real problem is that it's not integrated in the way that New York is. San Francisco is its own thing and Marin is its own thing. And like Berkeley is its own thing. Like all of it should be part of the same city, honestly. And that's politically unfeasible. Like no one wants to, because everyone is self-interested. And you actually just need someone from the top to be like, self-interest in this capacity is over. The Bay Area is clearly operating as a large city. Like it needs to be run as a large city so we can allow, so all these crazy, we get stuck in all these crazy things where like a certain neighborhood or a certain town will allow for, commercial, but not residential. So they'll build like tons of office space. And what that does is it brings in obviously a bunch of new people into the city, and to find housing, they have to move elsewhere in the Bay Area. And it just is like, it's like that kind of zoning shit is crazy. Like we need someone top down thinking about this and saying, first of all, I mean, I'm super like zone it. Housing should be it shouldn't be like housing is allowed here. That should be the default. Housing is allowed everywhere. You can't stop it. That's the new thing. Like if someone is going to build an apartment, there's no, you're not allowed to stop it, period. But then, I mean, people just have to be more thoughtful in a sort of more holistic way. Like what is good for the Bay Area? And until that happens, we're going to be getting caught into these weird struggles all the time. The transportation is going to be sort of fucked. And yeah, so I think there's a way to do it where you can maintain obviously the beauty of San Francisco by just lifting it up quite a bit. and then also working on like things that allow for better commutes and things like this.
Sure.
So doing the research for the show, I read through a lot of your newsletters. Pirate Wires, actually subscribed, was a huge fan.
Thank
you. Paywall got me, so the system does actually work there. But one of the ones I enjoyed the most was your talk about extraction and the accusation that tech in cities like San Francisco, states like California, is this extractive feature. And now that folks are saying we're going to move to Austin and Miami, it's these people who've come up, extracted all the value, and now we're just piecing. I want you to talk about the idea of extraction and what tech is bringing to San Francisco in the context of your point of people, of you saying earlier that people just really seem to hate tech in the city or a part of the governing class, because the audience advocacy side of this is going to say, look, there's a bunch of center left listeners who are going to say, no, like we don't hate tech. We just want wages to be fair. We just don't want people to be exploited. So can you just give your thoughts on the broader topic of what tech is bringing or maybe not bringing to the city?
Well, first of all, tech wages are more than fair. Tech wages are the best in the country, and we brought those jobs to the city. Most of the people, so there are plenty of tech jobs for people in the Bay Area. You could say that maybe there aren't, it's like the engineering jobs are bringing in new people. And then here we're having a sort of immigration debate. Are you for immigration or are you against immigration? And these are center-left people who are supposed to love immigration, but in the context of us bringing in engineers from other parts of the country, but also we're talking about a lot of Indian Americans, a lot of Asian, not even Indian Americans. We're talking about a lot of Indians and Asians from abroad who are coming into the country, which is great. They're talented, brilliant people who we need. And then suddenly immigration is a problem, right? And instead of saying, oh, there are too many like Indians and Asians here, they're saying, these tech bros, man, these fucking tech bros. And it's like, no, dude, you're just like actually a nativist person and you don't like immigration. Fine, like let's have that conversation, but like let's have that conversation. I think, so the extract thing is a meme that I saw bubbling up among two people. So you have the local politicians talking about this. And that was getting picked up by, I don't want to generalize in the tech press. I don't think everybody in the tech press is quite as bad as everybody else. Like there are some just really bad actors. And I would say a small handful of like just really bad actors who clearly are just, they're like attention grifting. They just want to, it's like tech bro whack-a-mole. They want to be saying how bad tech is every day in any way they can. And they're not thoughtful about it. They were picking up on the extraction meme. And the idea is that, you know, it's like these tech bros came to San Francisco, they extracted wealth, and then they left with the wealth. It's like as if it's oil or something. And we went in and like pumped it from the ground and went off. The word colonialism has been thrown around casually. It's like very wild shit. And the reason this is obviously, it's not, maybe not obvious, but like I have to, I kept being like, this is insane that people think this, but do they think this? They can't possibly think this. I'm just going to walk you through it.
Yeah.
The city budget of San Francisco has doubled in the last 10 years from $6 billion to $12 billion and over $12 billion now. That is because of all of the tax revenue that tech companies have brought into the city, first of all. Second, the wealth that is being created by tech companies isn't coming from San Francisco. It's coming from around the world, and it's not even being drawn from around the world. Tech is creating value globally. Global wealth is growing. Tech is a part of that growth. It's an accelerant. Nothing has been taken from San Francisco. San Francisco has been given opportunity for years and years and years and years. And you could say things like, oh, well, the network is here. And it's like the network, I agree. The network is a tremendous value. I personally did receive a lot. I received a lot living in San Francisco. And now the people who I received a lot from are themselves leaving. Like the people that you're saying, if the network is all you have and you're saying like sort of you came here, you took from the network and you left, it's like that's not quite true. I mean, it's not true at all. The network itself is what's leaving. That is the value. They're sort of roughly, they like almost understand. I think maybe in the back of the mind they do understand, but they don't like the conclusions that they're coming to. And it's like, yeah, like the people who came here are what made it as valuable as it is. And they lived here and they created tremendous wealth for the region. Like just like objectively, you can look at the budgets and you can see, oh, wow, look at all the tax revenue we brought in. And then the city just deteriorated. Not then, it's been deteriorating for decades. It's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And we're living in a world now of just I would say, metastasized human misery on the streets. We have mental illness, which is people mentally ill, sort of like roaming the streets, no way to help them, endemic drug addiction problems, facilitated by fentanyl dealers who are, it's like basically legal to be a drug dealer. And I'm not talking about weed or mushrooms. I'm talking about meth and fentanyl. It's almost legal. People are dealing in the subway. We don't call it the subway, but I'm trying to, for the national
for
audience,
the, yeah, sort of for
like
the
subway stops. So you have, it's like you have a homeless problem, you have a mental illness problem, you have a drug problem. Our public transportation is fucked. Our public education is clearly fucked. And we've just been, that's the Board of Education has been like a laughing stock nationally now for about 2 months. You have a government that is hostile to not only big business, but also local business, small businesses in the area. And now under COVID, you see that we have a government that makes just like, it's just insane decisions, not based in scientific reality. For example, shutting down like outdoor dining at a time directly following their instructions to local businesses to build all these like outdoor semi quasi shelters and heaters and everything like that. Like the moment that all the restaurants did that, they were like shutting you down. No scientific evidence supporting that. And the businesses are already gutted. And it's like, it goes on and on. Sanitation, corruption. Like I could sit here and list shit that's crazy about San Francisco forever. But the point is like, we have a class of people here who are doing a lot and who came in, who brought a lot, who gave a lot just by virtue of like moving here. We're giving a lot. We're creating. It's like there's an economic benefit to the city that's not small and not trivial. It's massive. And that was just not only squandered, I would say it was stolen. It was stolen from the people who were living here. So now you need a scapegoat. And who is an easier? So concurrently, famously, the city blocks housing at every possible turn. Really just, I mean, even ground floor housing projects that you'd think would be popular anywhere. For example, we have a housing project in my neighborhood for hospital workers. It's literally, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's a bunch of new units. They are affordable, and it's being blocked by the Marxist millionaire supervisor who runs my district. He's openly a socialist, DSA. He's retweeted things about nationalizing all industry and shit like this. It's like, first of all, what does that have to do with building housing in San Francisco? Can you just please stay focused? Second of all, he's apparently not even in favor of affordable housing. So that kind of shit is happening. That's like baked into the DNA of San Francisco politicians, this aversion to housing. And it's maybe one of the problem of problems, because in a city, you need a lot of people in a city paying money into the city to get to a scale where things like education and public transit get really good. And you kind of always, like urban planning type people, love a densely populated city. It's just the way that you get all the really cool city stuff. That problem, the housing problem, when you're not building, it's like clearly when you're not adding supply and the demand is going up because people are moving to your city, the cost of housing skyrockets, and San Francisco was already an expensive city. It was an expensive city even in our economic downturns. It was an expensive place to live because people want to live here. So that starts happening, and the local government starts demonizing tech, and that just becomes a meme. Tech people aren't focused on it. They're not paying attention. They're not combating it. I think some of them maybe even internalized it. They think, wow, we do have all this money. Maybe we are responsible. And it's like, you're not responsible for wanting to live in a place. All we have to do is build more housing. It's like pretty straightforward. Just build more fucking housing. And it's supply and demand. And they refuse to listen to it. And so that's how the scapegoating process began. It was like you have people sort of screaming from the rooftops that a small group of people screaming from the rooftops that tech is the reason housing is expensive. That builds negative sentiment in the region. Everyone, including tech people, feel the hit from the housing costs, which were and they're still bad under COVID, but they're better, which were insane right before COVID. Mm-hmm. And that low level sort of just anger permeated everything. And we've gotten to a place now. So it was like, I mean, tech people were blamed for the city being too expensive. Then the moment tech people started leaving the city, we were blamed for extracting wealth. I think that happened because the government was like, actually shit, like, we do need that tax revenue. We can't live in a city where we've already bloated the government in the last 10 years, that money didn't just go nowhere. They grew the government and they started paying themselves. And then, again, there's like endemic corruption in the city. And then a lot of it just goes to like paying, I mean, and I don't begrudge people a good salary, but we have like bus drivers making $300,000 a year and shit like this. And that's a lot of money that we're paying people. And that's the government. So they need us. We're leaving. We'll see what happens.
I think a lot of the frustration with this issue seems to come from bad language people are using, in the sense that they're bringing metaphors from different spaces and importing them into. So, for example, if you're thinking of the robber barons during the Progressive Era, using the word extracted makes sense if you're talking about coal and strip mining.
Yeah, you're literally oil, extracting. Yeah.
Like literal, right? That's what you're talking about. But with tech, if everything's on the cloud, this is not physically possible.
No, building. We're moving here, and then this is the cool thing about tech, right? Programming is basically magic. It is like their words, it's just a different language. They're effectively concepts, a set of instructions that you build out of nothing to do something that creates value out of nowhere. Like that, it's magic. And the people here are not extracting any. It's like the people are bringing value to the table. It's like they are the value. They're not extracting anything. Like it's them. They're the value, and they're sharing some of that value with the people who are their neighbors, who they live near, and then, because they've been abused for the last 10 plus years, they've decided in the middle of a crisis that maybe there are places that are better for them. And it's like, how do you blame them for that? They're just trying to find a place where they can, like everybody else on the planet, they're trying to find a safe, clean place where they can build a life for themselves, maybe start a family. And like, this is not a place right now that you want to start a family. And that's not the fault of tech. That's the fault of our own the policies of the city have made this place close to unlivable. And like, that's the problem. So that's what we have to fix. And I'm interested in fixing it, but it's like, I get so animated about this stuff because there's no way to fix it until you can just admit that you have a problem. You have to admit, like you have to be able to admit that your policies have created these problems. And until you can do that, you're never going to create the policies that make a better city.
You said something very key earlier, which was about, you were like, young people moving here, they don't even know who their city supervisor is. Mm-hmm. They don't know anything about city government. Marshall was on my show this morning on Rising, and I was talking about the ward. I was like, I live in DC. I'm like, I don't even know what ward I live in. I've lived here for 10 years. I literally lived in the city for 10 straight years. I voted in a city election one time. I didn't even know who the people who were running. I'm fully fessing up, you know, to this, and I'm guilty. All I really care about is national politics. That's what most people do. I assume the people in tech are, you know, politics is like an adjacent thing, or was for many years. And now, to the extent it's here, it's much more like identitarian than it is about actually doing anything. So explain to us the shift in tech thinking, at least personally embodied in yourself. And I would say I have seen some of your writing really take off, and like in my digital observation. We had David Sachs here on the podcast. He's like, yeah, we need to care about government. Like, for a long time, tech people just moved here and we just didn't care.
True.
And the political system just came in, and all of a sudden we came and saw ourselves on the other side. What do you think, as tech people, that you owe to San Francisco? We obviously have talked about what San Francisco owes to you. What do you owe to San Francisco? How would you encourage people who are young, who are moving there and more, to think about building a great city that they want to live in and has all of the benefits that you just talked about, both in terms of the view and just the general human capital running into each other?
Right. I want to be clear. Like, while I don't think there's no world in which we have extracted anything, no one in tech has extracted something from San Francisco. The value is us. It's not oil or coal like we were talking about before. We're not strip mining. It's literally our minds are the valuable thing that we're bringing to the table. And I think it's perfectly valid to leave any relationship where you feel that you're being abused. And I do consider what's happening in San Francisco an actual abuse. However, what do we owe? I mean, I think that anyone who lives anywhere owes that community. Well, it's hard, right? Because there's this question, it's like, are you passing through or are you not? And I don't want to say that just passing through and being a transient sort of person is a bad thing, but it's not something that animates me.
Yes.
Personally, what my sort of view on things is, like, wherever you live, you need to be a part of that community. And the absolute ground floor way to do that is to know who your fucking supervisor is and to vote in an election. Like, that's really the bottom of the barrel here. And I think that we all need to start there. You have to be aware of what's going on in your community. You have to understand. And it's so, in San Francisco, you have, I am frustrated with the tech. And in Extract or Die, which is the piece that you referenced just a moment ago, Marshall, and that piece did pretty well. And it's one of the pieces I'm happiest with myself. You know, I went off. I didn't just go off on the government. I went off on us too. And it's like, yeah, we can blame. Here's where the blame should be placed for San Francisco. It's not that we came in and we destroyed everything. It's that we came in and didn't get involved at all. We didn't get involved and ruin it. We didn't get involved. Like, we never got involved. If had the tech community thrown tons of money into local politics and ran candidates and actually came with policy ideas and tried to make the city better and to be a part of the city in a really serious, sort of aggressive way, I think things could be different now than they are. Part of this is, like, a lot of people come in and they don't think that, you know, they're like, who am I to tell these people who've lived here forever how to live? And I don't believe that at all. I believe in immigration. My grandma's an immigrant from Spain, but she's an American. She came here, and the moment she came here, she was an American. All it takes to be an American, in my opinion, is you love America, you want to be here, and you believe in sort of the American values. And that's the American dream. I love it. You come here for that. And San Francisco, I feel the exact same way. You moved here. You love the city. You're now a part of the city. You have a say in how it's governed. It's really that simple. And I think that we got to get over this aversion to making people feel upset and to, like, appeasing the nativists who've lived here a few seconds longer than you. It's like, that's not the way this works. Everybody who lives here and pays taxes has a say in how the government runs. And right now, the government is running off a fucking cliff. So it's, like, time to get involved. And I guess it's, like, at this point, a lot of people have left. So it's, like, too little, too late. Myself, I should have been talking about this 10 years ago, and unfortunately I wasn't, and I waited, and I was guilty of a lot of these things myself. Maybe a lot of what I'm doing is yelling at myself in these pieces. But I will say that, like, henceforth, wherever people live in the tech community, wherever you go, however long you've been there, you need to get involved. In Austin, people are always like, what do you recommend? And I'm like, well, I think Austin's maybe a little bit too late at this point. I think that there are a lot of problems that you're seeing in Austin. People are already blaming tech for shit, but that's been happening. People have been moving there slowly for a while. Again, it's coming down to the cost of housing. People are really frustrated with the way that housing costs are skyrocketing. But I would say anywhere that you're moving, anywhere in the country, you just have to immediately be aware of what's going on. You do have a little bit more money if you're, a lot of tech people have a little bit more money, not at every level, but I think a lot do. You have to give that money to candidates who have values that you share, and you have to help them get elected, and you have to have a say. You have to come in and try to affect change in your community. You have to try and make it better. I think I believe that we have a responsibility there. Maybe I certainly feel that I personally have a responsibility there. And when other people share that responsibility, I feel kinship with them. I don't want to judge again. I don't want to judge people who just like to drift around and they live their life a different way. I want to root down and, like, be a part of something.
Yeah. You know, let me ask you this, because this is really interesting to me. There, what you said there is that people didn't care. I've noticed that not just on the city government level, but on the national level in particular. And before all this, Marshall and I were in San Francisco. We were talking with some people who had founded, you know, huge companies. And one of them said something, I've said this here before on the pod, I thought it was very insightful. They were like, look, if you could found a unicorn company pre-2017 and you never had to think about politics at all. Now, tech itself is political. Like, no matter what you do, the medium of technology is political. To what end are you using technology? Who's allowed on your platform or not? What are your standards? Users? Is your tech being used for good stuff by China or by the US government? It's like, all of these are questions that they're literally just not able to handle, and in my opinion, have handled in a very ad hoc and ridiculous way. They've turned both parties against them miraculously. It's actually pretty impressive in order to see that happen. So how did that happen? Is it because of this like weird left libertarianism where they were like, we're, post-political almost, but they didn't realize they actually like live in a society with users and with government officials? And then what is the antidote to that? Like, does tech now have to be political in terms of both sides to save itself? What do you think?
First cut, a lot of the way that we think about politics in the country right now actually just comes from what we're seeing on social media. And social media is dominated by extreme voices. Yeah. And so what we see the most is the extreme left, the hard left view and the hard right view. And the hard left doesn't like business sort of conceptually. They have a problem with money, literally as a concept. I just read a piece from a journalist who made a funny comment, a flippant remark where it's like, and this is a sort of mainstream journalist who was just like, you know, some people think that like money is bad. And I get that. And I'm like, what do you mean you get that? That's like a crazy thing to say, that just money conceptually is bad. Like you get that. You have to unpack that and make an argument. That's crazy. That's like a very extreme position that you just casually made and like left there and moved on. So like, that's the hard left. They don't like money. They don't like money. They don't like business. Right. They believe they think business is exploitation. This is the hard Marxist left. And that's dominating the entire like far left. The hard right is, I think, harder to really characterize. I don't think it has much power, honestly. It's like populist. Populism bleeds into the left as well. It's like they have zero cultural power, but certainly what animates them right now is a reaction. It's like they're reacting to things that are happening, that they perceive to be happening to them. And what's happening to them is they're not being allowed to talk, right? That's the meme. They're being targeted for their speech. So in tech, it was like, the left eventually was always going to come to a place where it wanted to dismantle tech, just because that's the nature of the game on the left. Is once a business becomes too popular, it's an easy target. The far left hates business conceptually. They're going to go after it. We were always on a crash course with the left. A lot of people in tech, the vast majority of people in tech are center left to the far, and then they drift to the far left. Mm-hmm. And so at the social media companies, when it came down to moderation, there's a question of like, it's this basic philosophical question of what is true. Let's just start there. Forget all of the hate speech and shit like that. Just what is true? So when you're going to start moderating facts and saying, you know, this is true or that is not true, your bias necessarily leads you to believe that most of the crazy shit you're reading from the right is not true. And so it just blows my mind when people still try and pretend this isn't happening. It is very clear that the right is disproportionately hit by censorship and moderation. It's just straight old, it's like old-fashioned political censorship is what we're seeing. Not mass political censorship, but the censorship that's happening is disproportionately hitting the right. That drove them insane. And so now you have a situation where just as these companies are becoming massive and inescapable, our democracy basically takes place online. I don't believe that there's a person could win the presidency without social media at this point. Once we've hit that critical mass of users, the left is, their switch is on. They're like, powerful company, have to dismantle it. And now that company is censoring the right, their natural ally in business. And the right, the entire right is like, wait a minute, we can't live in a world where you need social media to exist in a meaningful way publicly. And also, they don't believe that any kind of conservative thought is legitimate. I mean, that's their read of the situation. And I think they're not entirely wrong because of the people who are in charge and just following the decisions they've made recently. There's clearly a bias against the right. And so, yeah, both sides hate them. And the tech industry did like everything wrong. Like for the last, I would say 5 years politically, starting with like the ground floor thing, which is that the tech just doesn't get involved. It has tried to stay out of it. Not even tried. I think it just hasn't been interested in it. Tech, business and technology are both extremely, they're fun. You can do things yourself. You can build things from nothing. There are no bureaucrats. It's just you and a blank page. And I'm a writer. And as a writer, it's the same feeling of just pure freedom. So I like writing more than I like podcasting. I like podcasting more than I like video production. And it all comes down to like the ease with which I can just tell a story. Yep. And I think tech business is the better version of government. Like government is all of these these blocks in front of you, like sort of slowing you down, impeding progress, impeding change, impeding experimentation. And the closer you can get to just like just pure creation, the more exhilarating it is. And so people focused on that for a long time. That was the first problem. They focused on that and none of the shit happening around them. And they believed they could just build their way out of any problem. And then they just made a lot of really basic political errors. It's like they picked the wrong allies and then they fucked the wrong people. And then they just kept pouring gasoline on a bad situation. And then they had those crazy, when Jack Dorsey showed up to the hearings with that giant beard, I was like, you have no one in your life who can just say, hey, like, maybe let's have a haircut before we
love a maybe. Maybe. Like, maybe.
He doesn't care. I just don't think he cares. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, wanna, just, yeah.
Yeah, I want to take this back to something because I want to steel man the position we're taking here, because you hit on this. There's a lot of bad actors on social media, politicians, reporters, columnists, etc., who I think ruin this debate because I think they're so clearly acting in bad faith that it creates a world where we're incentivized to structure a conversation around them. So I want to structure this more around what I think would be the more reasonable perspective here, which would be the following. So Mike, let's pretend I'm just normie person who's just sort of hostile to tech. Look, America really sucks right now. And in a bunch of ways, it's really sucked for the past 30 or 40 years. This is the, and I know the issue of income inequality is like complicated, but there's been this clear reality post 1970s that a lot of winnings have gone to like a very specific part of our economy. People who are educated, people who can transition to the cloud, people who can take the winnings of globalization. And there's been a whole part of our society that hasn't been able to benefit from that on the same level. So when you combine that clear economic reality with the fact that you get people, and honestly, like I'll be frank with us, we've had, you know, Balaji on the show a couple of times. I agree with a lot of what Balaji says, but sometimes when he talks about immigration as being a good thing, as he talks about like being willing to pick up and leave, I understand why people would react hostilely to that, because there is something around the idea of, hey, like we're citizens, we're in this together, and seeing people who have taken all of the, not taken all of the winnings, right? Because I'm not saying you're extracting, but people who've clearly benefited the most from a very specific set of economic realities and technological realities, basically taking a position which could be articulated as, well, we're just going to leave if we don't like what's going on, when a lot of Americans can't leave. Going to Miami isn't an option for most of the people who live in San Francisco. So how do you respond to, I think, this more reasonable frustration? It's emotional, but I think it's also a reasonable frustration. It's someone who would be like, you know what, like, fuck you. I can't immigrate, so I'm not going to be a huge fan of whatever you're basically saying.
Well, so I think, first of all, normies don't hate tech. I think the people who hate tech are like wonkish coastal elites and journalists, and they're the ones who are obsessed with the tech-lash narrative. Normies love Amazon. They love Facebook Business, where they can start a small business. They love selling their products on Instagram. They fucking love Uber. They absolutely love, I think I said Amazon, they love buying cheap things on Amazon. Like, I mean, these are all, they love Robinhood. They love, I mean, tech products are very popular across most segments of society. I think where, quote, normies get frustrated with tech, two things. One, the censorship stuff has been pretty bad. And then two, social media makes us all a little bit miserable. And that's almost every platform. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. And it's not just because people are mean online. I think it has to do with this keeping up with the Joneses thing. There's something about, so Instagram specifically is this window into other people's lives, but it's a fake window. And even if you know that, emotionally it hits you in a weird way. This is the mimetic nature of people, is they want what they see their friends have and what other people have. And it's like, that's how they get, and no one wants to admit this, but it's like people take cues on what to want from what they see. And so Instagram is now a window into a world of things that you can't have. No reasonable person is going to Dubai every 5 seconds. And like, yet on some level you're like, am I failing? Because I'm not, you know, in a bikini in Dubai right now and like hanging out with a fucking sultan, maybe. And like, that is why people get upset with social media companies. And I think that, I mean, there's polling on this. Like, a lot of tech companies are very popular.
No, Amazon's one of the most trusted brands in the world. It's true, in America. And people who are anti-Amazon or whatever, you have to grapple with that.
Yeah. Like,
Like, what is it? They have more. There are more people with Prime memberships than put up Christmas trees in America.
Yeah, no, it's huge. Like, there's a reason it's valued as highly as it is. It's because it's that valuable, actually. I think that normies love SpaceX and what it represents. They love that there's a man putting spaceships into orbit. The tech press has been trying to make Elon Musk unpopular for years, and they can't succeed because what he's doing is recognized by the average person as clearly meaningful and clearly impactful. So I guess I reject your opening premise. I do acknowledge that rich people can be obnoxious and terrible, and I do acknowledge that it's really annoying when people are talking about just leaving, and I love Balaji. I agree that there's, I think that you have to fight for your home. So I always think about it. I think it's much easier to think about even in the American I'm struggling with this in San Francisco because I can't actually figure out if we can fix it or not. And we could talk about San Francisco for hours. I mean, there are structural things here that are making it really hard to change. And the machine is all on the other side. And I'm not even convinced at this point that tech people fully mobilized could do much. There aren't that many tech people in the city to begin with, even before COVID, comparatively. But then in the national context, I think it's an easier question to think about. It's like America is slowly falling, let's say. And I believe actually we are in a sort of rough state of decline in a lot of dimensions. It gets really bad. Do you stay and fight or do you leave? And I personally believe that you stay and fight. I think it's like, this is my home. This is my country. I'm going to stay and I'm going to fight for it. And that's a value thing. And I think that people who kind of don't feel that, I find it frustrating as well. I don't think it's everybody. And I think tech in general has done just like clearly a lot of good in the world. And the reason it gets attacked is not because of any of the class things that you just talked about. The reason it gets attacked is because tech has destroyed the media business model, and it is upending power structures. It's like the people who are mad at tech are people who used to be in some form of power. Those are the people who are mad at tech, because tech is democratizing there are TikTok influencers who have more power than some of our politicians now. Like that's what those people are really mad about. The sort of like power elite type people. And they drive the narrative. But the reason the narrative isn't like, people have been wanting to make the Facebook privacy conversation work for years. No one cares. Zero average people care about that conversation. And it's because they get things out of these companies. No one's an Amazon story is never going to stick. Right now, I do think that Facebook's negativity is interesting, because I do think the average person has a sort of slightly negative to moderately negative opinion on Facebook, Twitter, maybe even Instagram at this point. I'm not sure. I don't have data on it. My sense is that people do. And I think it comes down to just the product is not making them happy. I think if the product was enriching their lives and making them happier, they wouldn't care about anything else. They don't care about the class stuff. They don't care about rich people. Is this product improving my life? Yes, no. And with social media, you have this problem of really it's addiction. And I think it's like, it's hard to wrap our heads around. It's new, but most of us are addicted to our phones. Social media is a huge driver of that. This is a problem that I think we're all sort of invisibly grappling with. Even when we talk about it, we kind of talk about it for a minute and it slips away. But I think it's a really huge problem.
This is a great place for us to close up around, which is social media. I mean, part of the reason why I've really appreciated you on a platform like Clubhouse is you'll have a chat about local politics, then, you know, Chase Boudin, who, did I pronounce that right? I always get this wrong.
I think
wrong.
It's Boudin.
Boudin.
I say Boudin, but I only ever read it.
Yeah, right. No, it's one of the, I read it and I fret, but whichever it is, the district attorney in San Francisco, you had an actual debate with him. And what was fascinating about that debate though, was it was a lot better faith and less acrimonious than that debate would have been if the two of you were dunking on each other in Twitter. So can you speak, I'm hoping this could be our more optimistic part of the conversation. Can you speak about how maybe social media is changing naturally? For example, people, we had Cal Newport on a few days ago. He's talking about young people are fleeing Facebook. I deleted Facebook. We don't spend time there. Sagar's pivoting from Twitter a bit. Do you think that the social media picture is going to look a lot more positive as we see audio, deeper communities, niche audiences sort of format? Or is that another area of
despair? First of all, I'll say this. On the Chessa thing, that wasn't a debate. I wasn't prepared. I didn't expect him to come in. I've tweeted about him a couple of times. I mostly focus on the Board of Supervisors. And so when he came in and accused me of I mean, he came in, it wasn't polite. He came in furious and accused me of spreading disinformation about him. The disinformation was that he worked for Hugo Chavez, which is true. You can Google it. Right. There are tons of citations. And so I was shocked immediately. I was like, wait a minute, what? And then I brought up citations. He was like, those are lies. And I thought, I was confused. I was like, I don't even know how to have a conversation with this person at this point. I'm used to dealing with journalists who, despite a lot of times I disagree with certain journalists online, but like journalists in general are thoughtful people who love to have robust like exchanges of ideas, and they like, they believe in some sort of truth, even though I think that we're all super biased, and I talk about this a lot, and they're willing to listen. Like when I have a conversation with a journalist, it tends to be, if it's one-on-one especially, and on Clubhouse, I've had really constructive conversations.
Yeah.
The Chesa chat was not that. The Chesa chat was like, once he did that, I thought, okay, there's no way. And he also was like, you're super disrespectful. So I felt like he was going to leave if I pushed him too hard. And I recognized that this was an interesting opportunity. So
what sorry I tried for mischaracterizing, by the way.
No, it's fine.
I will say that, yeah.
So what I tried to do was get him to commit to positions, at least. And I just kind of did a polite interview and just asked him questions and didn't push back much at all. And I tried to get him to commit to things that were in clear contradiction. And I think he did that. And I think anyone listening could have heard that. But on social media, I do think Clubhouse is really interesting. I think there's something really humanizing about voice. And when you're talking to someone, it's way harder to be mean to them because you can hear them. And that's like that alone is an interesting beginning. I think there have been so many trends over the last year in social media that are interesting in a way. It's like, I feel that new things are happening again for the first time in years, even though a lot of this stuff has been being built for years. It's just I haven't been cognizant of it. I've been stuck in this in the Twitter world while all this other stuff is sort of gaining popularity. And now it's like a wildfire. It's like a match was lit and everything kind of came together. And the combination is stuff like, so there, it's like Signal chats are a huge part of social media now, actually. Yeah. A huge invisible part of social media. It's all the chats you're having behind the scenes with small groups of friends you love, and you're sharing stories together, and then you're like retreating into that and then dipping into the main world. That's an interesting part of it. It's like you have Signal chats, you have Twitter, obviously. You increasingly now have you have your Discord audio chats or whatever. You have now you have Clubhouse, this sort of like interactive broadcast thing. I don't know what's going to happen with all. Substack is for me the most exciting because Substack, Marshall McLuhan talked. I mean, he's famously said, you know, the medium is the message. This idea is that the communications mediums with which we interact with the world tend to shape us fundamentally. You know, it wasn't that JFK thrived on television. It was like television created JFK. And I believe that that is just obviously true. Twitter gave us Donald Trump and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Clubhouse, in a world of just ubiquitous Clubhouse chats, if that is to happen, if it really is the next way, the next dominant medium, we'll see a Clubhouse president. But right now what we're seeing is all of our sort of quote public intellectuals are dipping away from Twitter, which is a medium designed for war, like outright, it's short form, so there's no nuance, and it's literally just enough room to murder somebody online, to murder an opinion online. So it's like our public intellectuals are dipping away from that a little bit, and they're able to expand in longer form where there's plenty of room for nuance, and there's plenty of room to bring in different sides, and there's plenty of room to show someone like, hey, I see where you're coming from, but this is where I strongly disagree. Oh, and there's also plenty of room to really murder. So there's plenty of room to like salt the earth, burn them to the ground, murder them, which is what we've seen historically. There's Antonio Garcia Martinez wrote a great piece in Wired. I think it was Wired a handful of years ago that was all about, it was like, we're just going back to the world.
19th century. Like, that was a great
Hamilton,
piece.
And even earlier, I mean, 18th, like we're talking like American founding, when you had all of these just warring presses, I would say it's sort of like that on Substack. It's a little bit different in that. So, and what he's talking about is the end of this idea of like a neutral press. Press was never neutral.
Paper record and all those ideas.
That's which I'm totally against, actually. Yeah.
Right. It's like we're going to be a world of biases, and we're going to be a world of sort of living with our biases on our sleeves, and the best among us will be open about our biases. However, the difference is that the medium is still different. We're not a printing press anymore with like a bunch of papers on the corner. Now all of that information it's like being populated into our phones 24/7. It lives in our pocket. We're attached to it. So it feels more emotional, I think. And it always, political ideas are always, they're already emotional. So that's something that I'm anxious about. In terms of optimism, it's like, I think it's good that we're getting away from just these medium forms, these mediums that are designed just for nuking people. And we're getting, we have now space to be a little more thoughtful. But every single technology, the interesting thing that McLuhan talks about, one thing, he has a million, right? He's brilliant. But yeah. One just idea that I loved of his is he talks about this assumption that we all have that technology is additive. Like that the television was everything the radio was plus video. Yeah. And that's not and that's not true. It's television is a completely, it's fundamentally different. Like once you're in a world of television, the shape of the world around it shifts. And I think that we make a huge mistake when we think that you know, Twitter was just it was just blogs plus. It's like faster and whatever. It's like, no, it's a fundamentally new form, and Substack is that. And Clubhouse is that. And so I guess what I'm saying is like, now that it's fundamentally new, it's just too—it's too early, I think, to know for sure what the negative externalities are, and there are going to be some. There's never been a technology yet that hasn't presented negative externalities. I'm certain there are going to be some. Will the positives outweigh them? I think it's just too soon to tell. I certainly know that the media landscape that we've been living on across for the last 5 years has been really toxic. Like uniquely toxic, probably in the last, like maybe within like the 20th century, it maybe has not been so toxic. But then again, I'm only 35, so maybe I just have a massive historical blind spot, but it sucks. Twitter was bad, and a world of Twitter plus other things feels healthier.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Mike, we could talk forever, man. We want to be respectful of your time. Thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it, sir.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
Hope y'all enjoyed the episode. Really enjoyed speaking with Mike. As Sagar pointed out at the top, we are more than willing to have the other side of these really contentious debates. So definitely send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com or comment on the Substack if you have any great leads or suggestions. As always, share this with your friends, subscribe to our Substack, check out our bookshop. We'll see you next week, and thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work.